Hello and welcome to OU's Nach Yomi. You can find this year posted at ouradio.org/nach or on my website, ericlevy.com, under the recording section. Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy, and I am pleased to bring to you chapter 34 of Sefer Yeshayahu. Some of the imagery in the last chapter was definitely sliding into the messianic. God with his burning fires, his eternal fires, Jerusalem described in near-utopian ways, rivers flowing out of Yerushalayim, which is very, very reminiscent of the apocalyptic final chapter in Sefer Zechariah. And while I mention that word apocalyptic, I'd like to take a moment to correct something I said many chapters ago. The word kalypsos in Greek means to cover up or to be covered. Apokalypsos, or apocalypse, means to reveal or revelations. And I said apocalypse means things that are hidden. It's exactly the opposite. It is the uncovering of that which is hidden. Well, getting back to this chapter, the imagery is even more messianic, especially as the target of God's wrath. And I have to warn you right away, there is a lot of wrath in this chapter, is Edom. Edom in rabbinic literature, I think in most people's minds, is equivalent with Rome, with a switch of the Dalid of Dome to the Resh in Rome. The two letters look very, very similar, Dalid and Resh. Radak actually says, Kirvu Goyim, Parsha Zu Atida. This chapter is of the future, that is apocalyptic. Hu al Churban Romi. It is on the destruction of Rome. Now, that doesn't mean the Roman destruction of the Second Temple. That means the destruction of the nation of Rome. V'achar kach zachar tshuat Yisrael. And then afterwards, in chapter 35, the next chapter, the discussion will be on the salvation of Israel. U'machut romi kulam edomiim hamachzikim dat ha-notzri. And the Roman nation, they are all Edomites, and they are the ones who hold on to the Christian faith. Va'afal pikein shenit arvu bahem amim acherim. And Radak is saying, even though other races and nations have mixed into the Roman people, umelach kesar edomi haya, the king, the Caesar of Edom, an Edomite king apparently became a Caesar. V'chein ha-molchim acharav v'romi. And therefore, there were Edomites afterwards who ruled in Rome. Hinei kishehitcharev eretz Edom v'hiromi. When the nation of the land of Edom, which is Rome, will be destroyed. Yetzu Yisrael migalut zeh. Then Israel will be redeemed from this exile. That is the exile that the Radak was currently living in medieval times. Shelo Yosifu od legalot, and there will never be another exile. V'amar al kol agoyim. The reason why it says in verse 2, on all the nations, gam malchut Yishmael teicharev bizman hazeh, even the nation of Ismael, of Yishmael, will be destroyed at that time. So according to Radak, Edom essentially is Christendom, and Christendom is the main course in this chapter, with Islam being served up as a side order. Now, in truth, connecting the two nations of Edom with Rome is ahistorical. Radak is aware of the difficulties, the factual difficulties in connecting Edom, which was southern Jordan, northern Saudi Arabia, to Rome, which was a European nation. And therefore, what he does is he tries to create the Caesar, the ruler of Rome, who came from the nation of Edom. Let's remember, though, that the Radak is living in some of the most horrific times known for the Jewish people. This is the time of massive oppression of the Crusades. Indeed, an anti-Jewish fervor would be so great that Judaism would be completely wiped off the map in Ashkenaz in Germany by the end of the 13th century, what with the Rindfleisches in approximately 1280. In Christian Spain, where the Radak hailed from, the culture was representative of the fact that it was on the crossroads between the Jews who were living in Muslim Spain. Actually, they weren't living in Muslim Spain anymore, because in 1140, the Almohadim, the Almohades, attacked from across the Mediterranean Sea up through the Rock of Gibraltar, essentially in Spain, destroying the more liberal and cultural the Arabs who were living there, and essentially made things a complete terror for the Jews, wiping them pretty much off the map. So the refugees in 1140 pretty much flood into Catalonia, which is this area of Christian Spain on the east southern coast of the Iberian Peninsula, and then they continue on into Christian Europe itself. So Radak really is part of that crossroads between Christian Judaism living in Christian lands and Jews who had been up to that time living in Islamic lands. Now, the Jews living in Christian lands were suffering just a little bit less than those living under the terror of the Almohadim, who attacked in the 1140s. So, in a sense, the Holy Roman Empire, that is Malchut Romi, was as bad for the Jews of medieval Europe as the unholy Roman Empire was to the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud, the ones who destroyed the temple and then Beitar and Matsada and the rest of it. So the prophecies against Edom and Edom's, for instance, in Tehillim 137, the famous Al Naharot Bavel, one has Edom mocking the destruction of the first temple. So the rabbis, in a sense, turn this into Rome's destruction of the second temple, even though it says Al Naharot Bavel. Essentially, Edom is a relationship to us. He is a child of Abraham, Esav. And therefore, it makes everything much more personal to say that the Rome that we're dealing with now, whether it's the rabbinic Rome of the destruction of the Second Temple under Titus and the terror that would take place under the Roman rule up and through the 6th century, and then afterwards when Rome got religion, specifically Christianity, through Constantine, that became a terror to the Jews at that time, probably even a worse terror, but another form of terror against the Jews, all the way up into the Mepharshim's time and later. There's also another connection, which is that Herod's father, Herod the Great, who was a ruler of Israel, was Antipater, and Antipater was forced to convert from Edom. He was an Idumean who was forced by the Hasmonaim to convert, which really came back to bite the Jewish people, because you can't force somebody to convert without creating a whole bunch of hatred, which is exactly what happened. So in any event, what we really have here, even though I think the Mepharshim all felt, although the Radak I think understands a little bit, that Edom really was Rome, that somehow they migrated north and became the nation of Rome, what we really have is that Edom is a symbol of the current state of oppression in the second exile. And as we await redemption from the third temple, that is redemption and the building of the third temple, it is Rome or Edom which stands in our way. And in truth, this does seem to be a prophecy of the future, a messianic prophecy. So who am I to say that Edom is not in fact the future Rome, at least symbolically, much like I said some chapters ago that Moab is a symbol of Gog Umagog, since it's not likely that Yeshayahu was really, really railing against Moab itself. More likely, though, Yeshayahu is, what I think is happening here, though, rather than talking about a final salvation, is that Yeshayahu is foreseeing the events that took place around the destruction of the first temple. And Edom sided with Bavel, and what they're predicting is the destruction of Edom because of that treachery, and the redemption after 70 years in exile, which we'll see in the next chapter. Remember that each return from exile is supposed to be the last one. So when the Jews came back from the exile of Bavel, they expected that to be the last one. And this one we expect to return from our current exile to go to Israel, and that will be the last one. But you really never know when it's over until it's really over. So I should point out that since chapter 36 begins with a historical recollection. We're currently in chapter 34, which is the destruction of Edom. Chapter 35 will be a salvation of Israel. And chapter 36 will actually become the historical recollection of Asher's march against Chizkiyahu. So some of Farshim just want to keep everything down to earth. That is, what have we seen? We've either seen that this is the Edom is representative of Rome or Christian Europe and the Jew's salvation from that. I suggested that this is a prophecy of the messianic future, but that future would be the destruction of Israel by Bavel and their return, and by Edom, who sided with Bavel, and their return to Israel after 70 years of exile. And there's another possibility that Edom simply would be destroyed by Ashur. And they, the prophet was saying they deserve their destruction, and it's coming from God because of the kind of treacherous nation that they are. This is what Ibn Ezra says, Kol ha-mefarshim omrim kizela atid. Every one of the commentaries says this is for the future, that is, it's an apocalyptic prophecy. Rak Rebbe Moshe Cohen amar ki Edom charva bimei Ashur. But Rabbi Moshe Cohen, that's Rabbi Moshe Cohen ibn Jikatila, a Spanish commentary whose work is lost, probably because it was written in Arabic, and we really only have him from quotations mostly from Avraham ibn Ezra. He says, Edom charva bimei Ashur, it was destroyed in the times of Ashur, the Kol HaParsha Hi Devekan, and all of this chapter is really a continuation of what we've seen before, which is against Ashur, and what we'll see in the future against Ashur. So that's a very long introduction, but I thought it necessary since the connection between Edom and Rome or Erom is often made. Anyway, what's weird here, by the way, before I finish off on this idea that the medieval Mefarshim certainly identified this Parsha as anti-Christian, anti-Holy Roman Empire, and part of their ultimate destruction, is that there's no Rashi in the first few Psukim. He's completely gone. There's no setup. He doesn't tell us when this thing is taking place. And I'm wondering whether he was censored. See, Radak says that they were notes from, they were Christians. But Radak is living in Christian Spain or close to it. And it's also a little bit later than Rashi, so there's not quite as much tension. But there's no doubt that Rashi, without question, had the Christian censors looking over his shoulders. And it seems very possible that whatever he wrote was stripped out by censorship. Anyway, continuing on to the next pasuk, Kirvu goyim l'shmoa l'umim hakshivu tishma ha'aretz umloa tevel v'chol tse'etza'eha. Approach, O nations, to hear, and give heed, you peoples. Let the world and all in it hear, the inhabited lands and all that are born of it. Now, we can break down the rest of the chapter into two sections. A, God brings destruction onto the land of Edom. The actual land of Edom, rather than the symbolic land of Edom, which is the Holy Roman Empire, was situated south of the Dead Sea, as well as east into the mountains of what is now Jordan, and a bit west into the land of what is now modern Israel. The border tended to shift as geopolitics kept things fluid. Lands got conquered and reconquered and unconquered. The land itself is red, hence the word Edom, from iron. A classic example of this being the famous red city of Petra. You can Google it, which is carved into the Jordanian mountainside. The Torah says that Esav started the nation, but there's no doubt that he really was continuing an existing people. He set himself up as lord over an existing people who lived in those red mountains. Remember that when Yaakov comes back from Laban's exile, from the Laban's house, he is met by Esav and 400 men. So there's no doubt there was some kind of brigand people living in the red mountains south of the Dead Sea, and Esav simply set himself up as lord of them. The second section starts in verse 11 and describes the desolation, the post-destruction time of Edom's land. I hope that you'll forgive me for not reading most of this chapter verse by verse. I'm going to read it in clumps of verses. It's pretty straightforward and linear, and the descriptions are very straightforward and very gruesome once you translate the language. Kiketzef l'Adonai al kol hagoyim v'chema al kol tziva'am. Hecherimam nitanam latavach, v'chalehem yushlachu figrehem yalev v'asham v'namasu harim midamam. Because the Lord's wrath is on all nations, his anger on all of their armies. He has doomed them, assigned them to their slaughter. Their hosts will be tossed, and their carcasses will pile up, rotting. The mountains will be drenched with blood. Remember, in its simplest sense, this is just a continuation of the Ashur march that is going according to the literal sense. That was the one that was cited by Ibn Jikatila, or cited by Ibn Ezra in the name of Ibn Jikatila. So Yeshayahu is really saying, in its simplest non-messianic sense, that the other nations surrounding Israel will also be destroyed every bit as much as most of the nation of Israel, and in fact, even worse. As I said, there is a lot of wrath in this chapter. It's pretty gruesome, so I'll keep reading on. Vinamaku kol tzava hashamayim vinagolu chasefer hashamayim v'chol tzva'am yibol kinvol ale migefen uch novelet mi te'ena ki rivetav hashamayim charbi Hinei al Edom terei v'al am chermi l'mishpat. God is speaking. Whenever you get heavenly imagery, one certainly gets the sense of messianism. So that's really what we're dealing with here. Do we take this literally or do we take this messianically? But translating the hosts of heavens, i.e. the stars, the moon, the sun, will rot. The skies will roll up or shrivel like a scroll, and all of their hosts will be like leaves which wither from the grapevine or like the shriveled fruit of a fig tree. Because my sword will overflow, i.e. overflow from the blood in the skies. Behold, it will descend on Edom, on the nation that I have justly doomed. Cherev l'Adonai mal'adam hudashina mechelev midam karim va'atudim mechelev kilyot elim. Kizevach l'Adonai bivotzra v'tevach adol be'eretz Edom. V'yardu re'emim imam ufarim im abirim v'yirivita artza midam va'afara mechelev yudushan. The sword of God is sated with blood, gorged with fat, from the blood of lambs and he-goats, from the kidney fat of rams, because God is bringing slaughter in Bozra, which is one of the main cities. Bozra is one of the main cities in Edom, and a great butchering he brings in the land of Edom. Going down with them are oxen and bulls and fattened cows. This, of course, is no doubt metaphoric, referring to the warriors of Edom who will die. And their land will be sated with blood, and the dirt will be saturated from fat. Kiyom nakam ladunai, shnat shilumim l'riv tzion. For it is a day of the Lord's vengeance, a year of payback for the fight against Zion. That is, Edom will be punished for taking a vicious stance against Israel in the times of troubles. And as I said, I believe in the three choices, whether this prophecy is contemporary, talking about Usher, whether it's messianic, talking about salvation from the Holy Roman Empire or some future troubles, or whether it's talking about Edom in the time when Babel destroyed the first temple, I believe that the last choice is correct. So if you look in Tehillim 137 that I mentioned before, Al Nahar Babel, Edom is singled out alongside Babel for reveling in the destruction of Yerushalayim. In that psalm, in that Tehillah, they actually sing as such, or their song is recorded. Zchor Adonai livnei Edom et yom Yerushalayim ha'omerim aru aru ad ha'yesod ba. Lord, remember the children of Edom, remember the day of Jerusalem, i.e. the day that it fell, when they said, quote, let it be destroyed down to her very foundations. So this is retribution. Our parak is retribution for Edom's approach in apparently always taking pleasure and helping the destruction of Israel. V'nehefchu nechaleo lezefet v'afara legofrit v'ayta artza lezefet bo'era laila v'yomam lo techbel olam ya'alea shana. Midor lador techarav laneitzach nitzachim in overba. Its rivers will turn to bitumen or lime, its dirt to sulfur, and its land will be burning, not lime, but pitch. Night and day it will never be distinguished. Its smoke will rise from generation to generation. It will remain destroyed forever and ever, devoid of travel. Sounds like Chernobyl, actually. And in that sense, it certainly has a messianic flavor to it. And now on to part B, what happens after the land is destroyed. V'reshua ka'at v'kipol v'yamshu v'orev yishkenu v'ah v'nata aleha kavtohu v'avnei vahu. I.e. Edom, will become the inheritance of owls and other types of owls, or maybe porcupines. Great owls and ravens will dwell there, and it will be measured with a plumb line of chaos, tohu, and a stone of nothingness, vohu. This is the opposite of the plumb line used to rebuild Yerushalayim in the last chapter and in other chapters. Moreover, tohu vavohu indicates a reverse of creation, the very creation in chapter 1 of Genesis, an anti-creation, a tossing back of Edom into the primordial chaotic state. God will unmake her. And as you can see, the identification of a lot of these animals is really tentative. I'll give it my best shot using dictionaries and other translations, but I think our guess is as good as, you know, your guess is as good as mine. Choreha ve'ein sham melucha yikrau, v'chol sareha yiyu afes. So we're stepping away from the animal infestation for a second, and the Navi promises her chore, I'm not going to translate that yet, will call out, there is no kingdom. Now, who were the Chorim? I think the Chorim, and the Mefarshim sort of go every which way, but I think the Chorim are the same Chorim which are the tribe of giants that were living in the land of Edom and who were wiped out by Edom when Edom moved into their territory in the area southeast and southwest of the Dead Sea. If you take a look in the second chapter of Devarim and in the 14th chapter of Genesis, you'll see there are essentially these genocides and wars against this. It seems that the whole world went on a campaign of destruction against this supersized race, which were called Chorim and Zamzumim or Zuzim and Amim. And all things considered, we shouldn't be too surprised that the locals wanted to wipe out such a giant race. So the sense is that just like with the Tohu Vavohu, things are returning back to their primordial pre-civilization state. The Chorim, as it were, are returning back to the lands of Edom, saying that the civilization that Edom has set up is being reversed back to its original state when the Chorim lived there. And then the Pasuk says all of its officers will be nothing. That is not only its kings, but its officers. Remember that from Bereshit Lamed Vav, from Genesis 36, where it goes through the whole tribal organization and descendants of Esav, we see that there were really two different geopolitical political units in Edom and Seir. One was under the rule of kings, and the other one were under what we call Alufim, Alufei Edom, or generals. Continuing on, V'alta, getting back to the desolation and the infestation. V'alta armanotea sirim kimos v'achoach v'mib tzareha v'hayita naveh tanim chatzir livnot ya'ana ufagshu tziim et iyim v'sair el al re'eu yikra achsham hirgia lilit u'matza'a lachmanoach shama kinana kipoz v'timaleit uvaka'a v'dagera v'tzila achsham nikpitzu dayot isha re'uta. Thorns will ascend its castles, nettles, and thistles in its fortifications. Don't forget that the metaphor for the armies of Ashur are thorns and thistles, Shamir and Shayat. But here, it may just be 100% literal that after a city is completely abandoned by humans, the thorns and thistles take over the very houses. It will become a dwelling place of jackals. Now, don't confuse tanim, jackals, with tanin, reptiles. A courtyard of ostriches. Wildcats will meet hyenas, long-haired goats, sa'ir, will call to one another, and even the Lilith will relax there and will find for herself a resting place. In there will nest the kippos. Rashi says kippos is the same as kippod from the previous verse. Ibn Ezra says it is definitely not a kippod, but a different type of bird. The BDB, a fantastic Hebrew lexicon, says that it's an arrow snake, which fits the rest of the verse, which is, it will lay down its eggs, it will brood them and hatch them in the shade, it's all very snake-like, and even vultures will gather together there. So the land, abandoned of humans, will return to the beasts that take up dwelling in the abandoned places. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't comment on the Seirim and the famous Lilith. The latter I left untranslated, but both terms are used for demons, Seirim for male demons, and Lilith for female demons. Take a look at Rashi. Ibn Ezra, in fact, says Seirim were a form of demons. Whether they were real or not is not the issue. The fact that people believe they were real is the issue. And Rashi and Ibn Ezra talks about it, but he talks about it very, very cautiously with his usual secrecy. When Seirim are mentioned in Acharei Mot, in the Azazel religious practice that was done to atone for the nation's sins in Yom Kippur. Lilith is around in very old Jewish literature as a female demon. There are some midrashim about the fact that she was the original Adam's wife, because in chapter 1 it says God created man and woman, but in chapter 2 of Genesis it says that there was only man and a new woman had to be created. That's not really what it means. It's the chapter 1 and chapter 2 are two different views of the same creation. But out of this idea came this female demon, which would be one who snatches children away from their mothers in the night. It's quite possible that ancient Israel, who Yeshayahu was speaking to, believes in these demons and supernatural creatures. They were created by God, so I guess belief in these shadim, in these demons, is not anti-monotheist. Rashi mentions it. He was certainly the best of monotheists. And in fact, in modern days, many religious Jews believe in shadim, and it doesn't mean that they are not religious.
However, one should remember mythology is mythology, and that the myth of a woman stealing baby was obviously the result of the reality that sometimes in the middle of the night, large night birds, birds of prey, would very occasionally steal into the open design houses of our stone house dwelling ancestors. And when there was no food around, they would steal babies. It happens in the world today where you have bears and other animals that when they're starving, break into people's houses and cause destruction to human beings as well. Don't forget that in the story of King Shlomo, one should remember that women knew not to necessarily sleep with their infants in their arms. Remember the woman there rolled over her baby and killed it. And today we also think that there's a certain risk when a mother sleeps with a child, although I'm not certainly being a doctor here or in no way saying what's right or wrong, but there is such a wisdom that it shouldn't be done. So the children were left on their own, and windows, there were no such thing as glass windows or anything over the windows. They were just holes in the stone houses, and there was always the possibility that a bird, a large bird, would fly in and take away the baby. Certainly the Leviathans, the Leviathanim, were recognized. When Yeshayahu talks about those, I think most people recognize that those are symbols and metaphors. So it's certainly possible that Israel also knew that the Lilith and the Sirim weren't that they were real Shadim, but that they were metaphors for, you know, powers of chaos, the dangers of the animal world. Or maybe they did believe in them. Either way, one should keep in mind that everything else in this chapter is a simple animal. And in fact, in the Masa against, I think, Damesek, many chapters ago, it also talks about the infestation of an abandoned land by animals, and there Seir is used alongside the other animals, and there's no mention of Lilith whatsoever. So I would translate Lilith here as a female night predator or some type of owl, and a Seir as a goat, but perhaps a goat has certain, if you look at its face, it has certain scary, you know, humanistic qualities, and perhaps the Lilith was a type of bird that had a near-human call, and it created a sense of a fear that was above and beyond the average animal, even though people were well aware that they were not shaven. Or again, maybe they thought that they were shaven. Dear Shumei al Sefer Adonai Ukirau, Echad mehena lo ne'edara isha ru'uta lo fakadu kifi hu tziva v'rucho hu kibitzan. Look for it in the book of the Lord and read it. Not one of these, i.e. the animals mentioned, is missing. Each pair is not left out because God commands it and his spirit brings them together. The most likely explanation of this verse is that it's a reference to the, when it talks about the book of God, it's referring to Sefer Bereshit, the story of Noah's Ark, when all the pairs of animals come to survive the impending doom of the land. Remember that in this parak we had the idea of Tohu Vavohu, an anti-creation of the cities of and the land of Edom, and a return to their primordial state. So it actually seems to fit the theme that we have an anti-flood story where the beasts win and the man loses, essentially. V'hu hipil lahem goral v'yado chilkata lahem bakav ad olam yirashua l'dor v'dor yishkenu va. And he, God, has laid down this as their lot. That is, this is where the animals will live. His hand has measured it for them with a plumb line, the plumb line of destruction that we saw before. For they will always inherit it, and they will dwell in it, in Edom, for every generation.